This is Angpula. I'm Sonam Yangjin. Welcome to the RIGS podcast. Impact is such a powerful word. There is a deep-seated desire within each one of us to do something impactful in life. Sir Ronald Cohen, in his book, Impact, Reshaping Capitalism to Drive Real Change, talks about the importance of shifting to a new system of doing business that is more impactful, whereby individuals and organizations are encouraged to find fulfillment in being part of something bigger than themselves. He calls that new system impact capitalism. This system aligns the investors and entrepreneurs with the objectives of the government in harmoniously working towards harnessing capital and innovation to solve social and environmental issues. His book provides huge inspiration to the rising generation of impact entrepreneurs. In his words, impact is the hallmark of the new generation. Sir Ronald Cohen is a pioneering philanthropist, venture capitalist, private equity investor, and social innovator who is driving forward the global impact revolution. He serves as president of the Global Steering Group for Impact Investment and the Portland Trust. He is a co-founder of Social Finance UK, USA, and Israel, and co-founder chair of Bridges Fund Management and former co-founding chair of Big Society Capital. He graduated from Oxford University and holds an MBA from Harvard Business School. Sir Ronald was knighted by Queen Elizabeth in 2001 for his leadership in developing venture capital industry in the United Kingdom. Sir Ronald, thank you very much for sparing your precious time to be with us. And it is an absolute honor and a great pleasure to have you on the RIGS podcast. So thank you very much for the honor, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Sonam. It's a pleasure to be in conversation with you and everyone in Bhutan.
Thank you. At the same time, I would like to inform sir here that I'm approaching this whole episode as someone who is new to the concept, or rather to the system of impact revolution. And there's a lot we could uncover. And as for our listeners, I would also like to inform that impact revolution covers there are different aspects to impact revolution, but we will mainly be focusing, or our discussion will mainly be on impact entrepreneurship in this episode. So Ronald, if you could tell us what impact revolution or impact capitalism is all about, and why do you think it is important for the world to adopt such a system?
So Sonam, we're all aware in Bhutan and everywhere else across the whole world that our system is creating environmental and social challenges that it can't solve. And over the last 40 years or so, we've seen the environmental movement focus very much on how to deal with environmental issues. And governments have spoken to one another for 40 years, and virtually nothing has happened. And so it brought me to the conclusion I started on this path nearly 25 years ago, that we really have to bring investment to tackle social and environmental issues. It wasn't enough to rely on government spending and philanthropy. And we invented in 2010, for the first time, the social impact bond, which was a security whose return depended on achieving a social improvement. In the case of the first social impact bond, it had to do with preventing prisoners from going back to jail. The more prisoners stayed out of jail after their release, the higher the return to the investors. That concept of the social impact bond, for the first time, brought investment into tackling social issues. But it did something else. It showed that we could move to optimize in our ventures and in our businesses, and in our investments, in our economy as a whole, not just risk and return, which is how capitalism had driven growth and prosperity, but risk, return, and impact, improvement in people's lives and improvement in the state of the planet. And that brought us to the realization that it is actually the only way to deal with the social and environmental issues we face, because they're so massive now that the system should no longer continue to create them. The capitalist system or the free market economy system, according to where you live in the world, those systems rely on free market forces. But these forces must be brought to bring solutions to our problems, not to keep aggravating them. And that made us realize that this impact revolution, we are already well into the first stage of it, this impact revolution is shifting capitalism, is shifting market economies to deliver solutions rather than to create problems.
Basically, impact capitalism, like you have mentioned in your book, is advocating that it is possible for businesses to do good and earn profit or make money at the same time, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, it has become the better way to make money. You can make more money by doing good and doing well at the same time. If you take a company like Tesla is very often criticized. But as an example of a business which brought environmental impact into its business model, it's a perfect example of how that impact attracts consumers and talent and investors to make a $1 trillion company at its peak. So today, if you want to deliver superior returns, if you want to create as an entrepreneur a venture which is worth the most, your best chance of doing that is not a venture that pollutes and creates huge inequalities in society. It's a venture that brings solutions to environmental issues and social issues.
I agree. Like you said, capitalism in itself, I mean, on its own, always held a negative connotation for its profit-driven nature of the system, right? But impact capitalism provides a completely new perspective or outlook on how businesses can thrive sustainably with minimal negative impact to the environment and society at large. So, sir, as a pioneer in the field, how have business models and investment landscape changed over the years that culminated to impact revolution, ultimately encouraging the rise of impact entrepreneurs? So why was there the need to bring impact into the picture?
So if you look at the world from above, you can see big forces changing the world now, just as you could see them when I was in my mid-20s, 50 years ago, and I discovered venture capital and tech evolution. The first force is a change in values. Starting 15 years ago or so, young people refused to buy the products of companies that were creating harm, didn't want to work for them. Investors became aware that this had implications for the profitability of their companies, and so you began to see ESG investing shoot up. When I chaired the G8 Social Impact Investment Task Force 10 years ago, the amount of ESG in the world was about 13 trillion. Today, it's over 40 trillion. And ESG stands for Environmental, Social, and Governance Investment, which seeks to achieve both financial and impact returns. That change in values has really led to a massive change in financial markets. It shifted the values of companies. You can no longer invest in a coal mining company and make money out of it. It's become taboo, and for those who continue to do it, they're basically running their venture to the end of their cycle. There's no future to it. The second major force is the force of technology. Now, if you look at the tech revolution, which started in the early, late 60s, early 70s, 50 years ago, the tech revolution came because you had a convergence of technology in the form of the microchip and miniaturization that enabled so many new innovations to transform our lives, including the cellular phone and then the internet and so on. And today, we see a similar force of technology also coming with the force of entrepreneurship, as it did then, which is the force of AI, machine learning, augmented reality. These forces together transform our investment and business environment. The disruption that came from tech entrepreneurs like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg and others is going to be occurring again. It's already started to occur yet again. So you have a change in values and you have new technologies, and these new technologies enable you to deliver impact in ways humanity could never do before. You can now teach the same lesson to 1 million people virtually, simultaneously. We could never do that before. We can do the same with telemedicine. We can invent new forms of financial services that help people whom the banking system has previously charged too much for. And so you see these two forces coming together once again to transform the way we live and the way we work and the way we invest. But there is a third force, Sonam, which I didn't realize was at work 50 years ago, and which is at work again now. And that is the force of measurement. 50 years ago, I hadn't appreciated, when I discovered entrepreneurship and tech in the late 60s, I hadn't realized that the measurement of risk was behind the expansion of venture capital investment. In the 50s at the University of Chicago, academics began to measure risk. Up until then, Sonam, as you know, risk was always there when an investor made a decision, but the financial return was measured without the risk being measured. From the 50s onwards, we began to measure how a stock or a bond has moved up and down over its history and take that as a proxy for its underlying volatility or its risk in other terms. Now, that brought completely new thinking. For the first time, you could think of risk-adjusted return. If you had a risky venture led by a young entrepreneur with no business experience who wanted to change the world, maybe the return was sufficiently greater than a normal return that it justified the risk. So the concept of risk-adjusted return began to transform investment thinking. Alongside that concept came the concept of diversification. So if you have many opportunities of different kinds, venture capital, private equity, hedge funds, property, which all have different risk-return characteristics, maybe you can optimize your return, you can increase it to the maximum with the lowest level of risk by diversifying your portfolio. And that measurement opened the door to venture capital making its way in investment portfolios. Now, when I started out, there was no venture capital in a pension fund or an insurance company portfolio. A few wealthy people were beginning to play with the idea. The average size of a venture capital fund in 1969, when I left Harvard Business School, was $2.5 million. Nothing. Today, you have funds in the billions, in venture capital, more than $1 billion, and in private equity, in the tens of billions, right? And so the concept of measuring risk transformed investment portfolios to accept new forms of investment that could capture the returns of technology and globalization, which was also viewed as very risky. Today, you have something very similar happening, except this time it's the measurement of impact, which is additional to the measurement of risk and return, which is transforming the way we do business. We are on the threshold now, Sonam, of having impact statements published by companies that show in monetary terms their sales, their costs, and four categories of impact: their operating impact on the environment, their employment impact on people, and their product impact and their supply chain impact on people and the environment. That transparency, which has already begun to make its way through our regulators, we have the SEC with a very big proposal on environmental transparency. We have IFRS, which is responsible for financial accounting in the rest of the world, standardizing the measurement of both environmental and social impact. We have the International Foundation for Valuing Impact, which I'm privileged to chair, which is monetizing these impacts so we can compare impacts and sales and profits. These things are about to happen. They will happen in the next couple of years only. And in my view, Sonam, to answer your question, this is going to be the watershed between risk-return economies and risk-return impact economies. And it's what's necessary to tackle the big challenges we face. And it's happening out of necessity, and it's now happening very fast.
In a way, I feel that impact revolution, there's a strong resonance to what Bhutan's development philosophy of cross-national happiness has been advocating over the years, where environmental conservation and promotion of sustainable socioeconomic development have been one of our focus areas. And I feel it could also be applied in terms of how we do business. But what we lack right now is how we measure it, as opposed to, impact revolution, like you mentioned. So how do you think a small country like Bhutan can work towards attracting impact investors? Or what kind of measures are needed?
Well, first of all, from my visit to Bhutan, I saw the aspiration of your communities and your leadership to go in this direction. And I think Bhutan could well become a hub for encouraging the research and the development of impact thinking. So I think there is a natural role for Bhutan to play as a convener in this impact space. If you think in terms of how you encourage capital flows to achieve impact as well as return today, the first is to encourage entrepreneurs to set up ventures that begin to address the educational and the health and the other challenges that Bhutan faces on its way to greater development. The second is to provide incentives in the form of capital, matching capital. So if you saw how venture capital investment got going in the UK and in Israel, it got going by government saying, look, if you will invest here, we will invest alongside you, and we will take a lesser return than you will. So I think incentives to entrepreneurs that perhaps give them the opportunity to raise capital more easily, to give options to their workers, which are not taxed, in unattractive ways, and then to provide incentives to investors, probably through some form of junior matching finance that gives them an incentive. But a lot of it really has to do with spreading the idea. I think the idea is so close to the philosophy of Bhutan that entrepreneurs and investors will be inspired to help those whom rising prosperity always leaves behind. And so this podcast is, I hope, the first in a series of efforts on your part and the part of the RIGS organization to spread this thinking and its methods within Bhutan, so that it ties very naturally into the value system that you've very successfully created.
Thank you, sir. I can assure you that we have started our groundwork. We are looking at how we can help our entrepreneurs to achieve their full potential and create a vibrant community of impact entrepreneurs. So we have it is a good news that many positive initiatives will follow.
Yeah.
Sir, in your book, you mentioned that social initiatives need to be connected to investment in order to drive entrepreneurs to finance purpose-driven business and charitable organizations. We have several of such entrepreneurs in Bhutan, but as far as I'm aware, most of them are not connected to investors. So what would be your advice for them to attract impact investors? And at the same time, what would be your advice to the government who can support the fledgling startup ecosystem towards creating a vibrant community of impact entrepreneurs?
It's quite simple, really, Sanam. The supply of capital creates its own demand. So the government of Bhutan has to increase the supply of venture capital. It's very difficult to do this without the government leading in it. So let us imagine now that the government decides that for every fund that manages to raise money from outside investors, the government will put up a third of the money or a quarter of the money, and that money will make a fixed return of 5% if the fund is successful. This boosts the return that the private sector investors can make because they are not capped at 5%. So they can hope, and that's what happened with the first Bridges Impact Fund in the UK, they can hope to achieve returns of 10 to 15% in that way, by investing in ventures that address issues in agriculture, issues in education, issues in health, issues in taking unemployed youth and training them to get into employment, issues in reskilling adults whose jobs are in danger because of changing technology. So I think the leadership has to be from the government in increasing the supply of capital. There is today a huge movement across the world that focuses on impact investment. As you've mentioned, I preside over the Global Steering Group for Impact Investment, the GSG. We're now operating in 43 countries. It would make sense for Bhutan to become part of the GSG. On one side, India already is part of it. On the other side, China is in the process of joining the GSG. And that's where I think RIGS comes in. You have to tie Bhutan into the global impact investment movement. And benefit from the work which is being done across different continents and many countries to create an ecosystem that can support impact entrepreneurship and impact investment.
So what are the building blocks of a successful impact entrepreneurship venture?
It's a different mindset, Sanam, from just trying to make as much money as possible. It's a mindset that says, I'm dealing with three dimensions, not two. There's the risk, there's the financial return, but I also want to achieve an improvement in the lives of individuals and the state of the planet. So sometimes it's quite difficult for someone who is only used to making as much money as possible and not worrying about anything else to change their mindset. So a new generation of entrepreneurs is coming along now. Some of them are not so young, like Elon Musk, but they're young thinking. And they are starting by putting impact at the core of their business model. So to give you an example in the area of education, I invest in very early stage Israeli tech ventures. There is a company called Master School, which realized that for a student to learn coding, for example, or data analysis, is a very expensive thing to do. So they created a different business model for Master School. It's a business model where they pick candidates from those who come forward and say, I want to learn coding, data analysis, or any other profession. And the student only pays for the education after they have got into a job, when they have the ability to pay, so that they don't have to get into debt. And if they fail to get their qualification, find themselves saddled with debt and a low-paying job. So here's an example of being motivated by the impact to develop a more competitive business model for education. Now, if you compare it with the investment that used to be required in bricks and mortar to create a school and in having physical teachers, teach in a single location and so on and so forth, it's a much more effective, much more competitive model, capable of much greater growth, but also of huge delivery of impact. Now, my book has now been translated into 14 different languages.
Wow.
These concepts work in every country. There are two things I've learned in my career, Sanam, at least. One is that talent is evenly distributed across the world. What is not evenly distributed is opportunity. And we are in a stage of development as humanity is in a stage of development through technology, where it can really spread education and opportunity across the whole world in ways that we can, we could never do before. The second thing I learned is that the best way for an entrepreneur to be successful is to start young, to think big, and to stick with it. And that has been the role model that has led to so many great companies being created, like the ones I've already mentioned, Apple, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, and so on. So there is a ripe environment throughout the world for impact entrepreneurship. And coming back to what the government can do about it, supplying the capital that is required for young people to start young and think big and to stick with it is the first step of it. Initially, people say, well, there are no entrepreneurs, there are no impact ventures, why do you need capital? But they miss the point. When it's easy to raise capital, everybody wants to raise it. Everybody wants to improve their lives through their hard work and their inventiveness. And that's why I say the supply of money creates its own demand.
I recently had a chat with an entrepreneur friend of mine to get a sense of why most of the entrepreneurs in Bhutan do not have investors. And that's exactly what he pointed out. He said that there's a need for a venture capital among other forms of financing. So exactly what you pointed out. And you pretty much responded to my final question, which was what would be your answer to, I mean, what would be your advice to young entrepreneurs, businesses, and investors who wish to take their ventures beyond the bottom line to drive societal change? If there's anything you would like to add apart from what you've just mentioned, sir.
Yes, I'd like to say that each of us is passionate about something. I left Egypt, my birthplace, as a refugee at the age of 11. I came to Britain. I didn't speak English. My parents lost everything. They had to make a living. It gave me a responsibility for ensuring that I could make a sufficient living to be able to help them have decent lives in their old age. I became passionate about contributing as I did well. The 60s were an idealistic time. It wasn't all about just making as much money as you can or want. It was about improving the world. And that feeling translated itself into everything I've done in my career. I became a venture capitalist because it was a way of creating jobs at the time, by creating ventures at the time when unemployment in the UK was 3 million people, right? I then got involved in impact investment because I'd been helped as a refugee. I'd been given a wonderful education, wonderful opportunities. I wanted to do the same for others. It set me on the road to impact investment. And today, because finance has been my world and entrepreneurship has been my world, I'm doing that in the best way I can by trying to change our ways of investing, of doing business, changing our economies. But there are people listening to us today who are passionate about education, who want to help to educate others. There are some who are passionate about health, who want to improve the health of people who don't have access to education. There are some people who want to improve the access to finance of poorer families, who want to help them spend the money they have more intelligently, create platforms to help them to do that. There are some people who are motivated by the environment. They want ways of improving agricultural yield that don't lead to soil erosion. For example, they want to use technology to achieve that. And so I think you start as an entrepreneur by saying, what am I really excited about? What am I passionate about? And if it's one of these areas, then you begin to think of what's a business model that can deliver impact as it delivers profit. Because that's the future. That's inspiring. It helps you to attract the talent. It inspires investors. And you create something that's much more powerful when you have a group of people who have an aspiration that is greater than their own self-interest. When you are aiming for a greater goal, your motivation is even higher. So begin by where you're passionate, work out what the business model could be that delivers impact as well as profit at the same time, and then begin to develop that business plan so that you can raise venture capital, recruit your initial team, and get going. One of my favorite sayings, by the way, I wrote the book before I wrote Impact, about entrepreneurship and venture capital. And it just occurs to me that you should read it, Sonam, and other budding entrepreneurs. should read it. It's called The Second Bounce of the Ball. The Second Bounce of the Ball, as I said, is all actually about my becoming a venture capitalist and an entrepreneur and creating Apex. But it draws the lessons around being an entrepreneur and how to build a venture and how to build a venture capital investment firm. Because some people in our conversation here today will take away for themselves that they want to be an investor in venture capital. They'd like to be a venture capitalist. They'd like to fund other entrepreneurs. And the concept of the second bounce of the ball was that everybody can see the first bounce of the ball, right? Everybody can see what is happening now with artificial intelligence, for example. But they can't see the second bounce of the ball. They can't see, they could see the microchip, but it took a while before you could begin to see the internet. But if you could see the cellular phone and the internet ahead of others, then as an entrepreneur, it gave you a very big advantage. And so with Impact today, we're going through something very similar. We're going through entrepreneurs imagining, as Elon Musk did with Tesla, what if I could really come up with something revolutionary that would become the leader in the whole of an old industry? And that's what these new technologies are enabling us to do. So having within Bhutan a place where you teach entrepreneurship, where you teach about technology, where you teach about impact, where you enable budding entrepreneurs and venture capitalists to perfect their thinking and their plans, is probably an important part of the ecosystem alongside the government incentives that we were talking about. But if I may, I'd like to expand the conversation by one more dimension. When you begin to measure impact, as in the social impact bond, you begin to open the door for government to deploy its spending in much more effective ways. Typically, governments spend money, they measure the money spent, they don't measure the outcomes achieved. And it's been like that forever. But with impact thinking, governments are beginning now to create an outcomes budget or an impact budget. If you have a budget to spend so much on education, what is your outcomes budget? How many students do you expect to graduate with what level of attainment in primary education, secondary education, tertiary education, and so on, right? And the way for government today to deliver improvement in social services, for example, in my view, goes through impact measurement and pay for success. So if, for the sake of argument, the government of Bhutan decided today that it wanted to raise $500 million or $1 billion to improve the welfare of its citizens in one area, and it promised to pay investors according to the outcomes that they had achieved. Let's assume it's an increase in primary school graduation or secondary school graduation or tertiary education and getting into jobs. By promising to pay for an outcome, it attracts investors who will fund Bhutanese organizations, charitable ones, as well as for-profit ones, that are dedicated to improving the dropout rate from education, so more people actually graduate, or improving the diet of the population so people don't contract chronic illnesses like you know, diabetes in many parts of the world. So I think when we think in terms of entrepreneurship and impact, we need to supplement that with government thinking about pay for success and outcomes measurement. And the evidence today is that it costs half as much to deliver better services through pay for success than it does through fee for service. So this really is a revolution. I hope this conversation has left you, Sanam, and our listeners with the feeling that this is not an exaggerated statement. Humanity is living through a revolution which is bringing the well-being of people and planet to the center of our activities and our economies.
So, Ronald, it has indeed been an insightful and really inspiring episode. Thank you very much for the honor and for all your insights, sir. I would highly recommend Sir Ronald's book, Impact, Reshaping Capitalism to Drive Real Change, especially to our rising generation of impact entrepreneurs. So please have a read and be inspired to drive real change. Thank you very much, sir. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you. All the very best. Bye-bye.